looking forward, looking back. Twitter heats up as President Barack Obama signs on. And the Guinness Book of World Records confirms he is now the most followed person to join. And you know the names, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and Tamir Rice, but do you know the names of these women? And later in the show, connecting the dots from this week's events in history to today's headlines.
Our panel tonight, Philip Martin, senior reporter, WGBH News. Callie Crossley, host, Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, 89.7 WGBH. Peniel Joseph, professor of history, Tufts University. And Kim McLaren, associate professor of writing, literature, and publishing, Emerson College. To join the conversation, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
Well, big news this week in the social media world, and actually in all of our worlds, President Barack Obama signed on to Twitter. Now, you might be confused thinking he was already on because there was an at the White House account, but it wasn't managed by him. Mm-hmm. Now he's doing his own thing, so he signed on saying, hey, it's Barack. And I thought some really interesting responses, particularly from Bill Clinton. I love Bill Clinton's response, which essentially said, his Twitter name is @POTUS, which is President of the United States, and Bill Clinton wanted to know if the name went with the office, with him, because his hashtag was just asking for a friend. Which I thought was extremely clever.
That was so funny.
It was good. But on the downside, of course, he was also hit with a lot of racist tweets as well. But what do y'all think about President Barack Obama actually tweeting himself?
Well, I think it's a great idea. I don't think he's going to be spending hours following other people and reading other tweets, but I think it's another way for him to access especially a younger population. I think he only had 4 tweets as of, which most people do in an hour. So he's not going to be doing it extensively. But, the racist vitriol that was predictable was disappointing, but I think we should keep it in proportion. I don't know, I think he had received probably 10 times as many I love you POTUS tweets as he got racist vitriol.
Yeah. I also loved just the fact that the way it brought in time, the way we look at time now. I mean, 2015, it just sort of put an accent on the notion of the modern era, 2015. Mm. I was thinking about Nixon. If Nixon had tweeted, would he have said, I am not a crook? I mean, at the time, he was under investigation. And to see, the president, sort of joining, as Michelle Obama said, it's about time, I thought was very intriguing. And it just says something about the era that we live in and how much we depend in many ways in terms of communication on social media, particularly I think on Twitter more so than Facebook right now.
Well, also the expectation, Peniel, that there's going to be direct communication. I mean, again, there was an account that allegedly represented him, but it was maintained by others.
That's right.
But now he can say what he wants.
Oh yeah, and Valerie Jarrett said that we finally let the bear loose. He's been wanting to be on Twitter all this time. But I do think the racism is important, because I remember the racism on Twitter after the Hunger Games showed us the way in which young people are thinking about race in the 21st century. So I think that if you have the president of the United States, and there was all these tweets about hanging him and lynching him, I think it sobers us up in terms of where we're at in 2015. So it reminds me of when you think about Reconstruction in the United States, where Reconstruction was this extraordinary time period right after the Civil War, 1865 to 1877, where you had African-American congressmen. We usually focus on the men, but there were a bunch of black women during Reconstruction who were part of these club women movements, these women who were beautiful, educated, all these different things, but they existed side by side with the Klan and terrorism, racial terrorism. And so now you've got the first black president of the United States. He's in the White House, Michelle Obama, Sasha Malia, all these different things. But we have all this vitriol that's not different than 150 years ago. So I think it sobers us all up in terms of what kind of nation we live in.
Different only in the sense that it's amplified. Yeah. And the problem, if you think the Secret Service was busy before, I mean, and incompetent, many people felt, because of the many breaches that occurred, they're going to really be busy busy now with Twitter. Right. I think the president must realize that, of course, yes. because you sort of love the fact that it's sort of as Pinnell pointed out, shows right. what's going on, but at the same time, it only amplifies the problems of race in the country in many ways.
Well, let me put a button on it. I just found out that all of those tweets are archived, mm-hmm. so they can go back and review. And you know, if you say whatever you say, it's there for them
Good.
To look
to
at.
Find
and,
you.
And there you are. So mm-hmm. you know, think about that, folks yeah. who are tweeting to at POTUS. Mm-hmm. Let's move on, and it's really a hard flip. And we've been talking about the young black men who have been mm-hmm. Killed by police in mm-hmm. various circumstances, as young as Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old who was mm-hmm. gunned down mm-hmm. In Cleveland. And there has started, and speaking of online and the use of hashtags, a campaign called hashtag Say Her mm-hmm. Name. Mm-hmm. And it's in reference to the fact that there are some horrible situations that have happened with young black women yeah. involved with police that have equally suspect circumstances as we've discussed with like those of Tamir Rice, but yet those are not names that we know.
Right.
And so wondering what, had you thought about that, Philip?
I had thought about it, and I must say that this hashtag activism, in this case, Say Her Name, is very important mm-hmm. because I had thought about it, but it hadn't, again, using the same term I used earlier, hadn't been amplified. Twitter helps us do that. The other day, I'm looking at something totally unrelated, and then say her name, say her name, say her name. All of a sudden, tweet after tweet after tweet is being is coming across, and
right.
it's coming across. It's part of it's a Newsweek article. Mm-hmm. Part of it is other articles talking about this campaign. So yeah, I thought about it because you think about the sexism involved in our concern,
and especially please. Given that many of the organizers, some of the most powerful and competent or not. And competent organizers of the Black Lives Movement were women, mm-hmm. are young women.
Yeah,
some
yeah.
of the most active leaders of the Black yeah. Lives Movement are women. And so they started this movement and, you know, to address police brutality, and it became focused on the police brutality against black men because that does happen at a higher number. But
yeah.
there are black women who have been the victims of this. So I think this campaign was powerful. And what's really powerful is it wasn't just hashtag. Yesterday, across the country, there were actions. There was one in San Francisco. There was one mm-hmm. in Oakland. Where black women actually, you know, stop traffic topless mm-hmm. to talk mm-hmm. about, you know, how black women's bodies are not here for your exploitation mm-hmm. and your commodification. It was very powerful. It didn't
yeah.
happen here on the East Coast very much,
yeah.
but they're going beyond hashtag mm-hmm. activism, mm-hmm. would say her name, and saying black women are victims of this too, and we have to remember their name, Rekia Boyd,
yeah,
and some of these other ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really important. I think we should also stress you can do both.
Right.
The reason why there are black women's groups and black men's groups, but then also black groups, is that you can do both. There's transgender, there's mm-hmm. LGBT. So I think this is an important, massively important intervention.
And by the way, some have said in the Say Her Name campaign that the transgender black women have been particularly targeted. Mm-hmm.
And they yes. have. They have in cities, yes. absolutely. So I think you can do both. I think the important thing for us, the reason why we focus so much on black boys and men, is that the numbers that they're being victimized just across the board, not just criminal justice, but in terms of lack of access and poverty and different stuff, are staggering. Mm-hmm. The numbers for black women heading poor households are staggering, and they're the fastest growing prison population mm-hmm. right now in the country. So it's very, very important. I think one of the biggest things, Alicia Garza, who started the Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. one of the co-founders, she came to Tufts, and she was talking about all these different women, including the transgendered women. So the Say Her Name activism is important in terms of putting young black women at the forefront as leaders of what's going on, because they are the leaders already, but they haven't been getting
right.
That kind of play, that kind of acknowledgement. So I think this is huge, and this is really important. And one thing I will say, too, is that different academics and different law professors, people like Kimberly Crenshaw, have been connected to this. They've been doing town halls trying to focus on public policy and black women
okay, right.
in a big way. So this is really tangible. This is not just, you know, mm-hmm. Phil talked hashtag activism. It's really tangible. They're
right.
trying to connect it to policy forums across the country.
Okay, let me turn again and take a look at something that happened this week in history that is speaking to the Fergusons and the Say Your Name mm-hmm. campaign, and that is Malcolm X's birth,
mm-hmm. yeah.
May 19th. And he was and still is someone that is considered a stalwart in activism. You know, he went through his own changes personally about how he wanted to address what he thought needed to be addressed in American inequality. But Malcolm X was powerful, and I think speaks right now to where we are today. Wouldn't you agree, Peniel?
Oh, absolutely. 90 years old on May 19th, and he's the quintessential black working class leader of the 20th century for both African American men and women. He's poor. African-American from Nebraska and Lansing, Michigan, who comes to Boston, comes to Detroit, comes to Harlem, and becomes a juvenile delinquent. He goes to Charlestown, Massachusetts prison from 1946 to 1952, joins the Nation of Islam in 1948 in prison, comes out, he's paroled August 7th, 1952, and for the next 12 and a half years becomes the most articulate and bold spokesman for black political self-determination that the country has ever seen, including Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. So Malcolm X is unapologetic in saying that black lives matter, and also saying that the lives of black women, children, and men are important and sacred and sacrosanct. Malcolm never defends black humanity to white people. He affirms black humanity to black people.
Right. Right.
And that is his
right.
biggest contribution to the struggle.
So let's take a listen to Malcolm X himself.
Okay. The black people in this country have been the victims of violence at the hands of the white man for 400 years. And following the ignorant Negro preachers, we have thought that it was godlike to turn the other cheek to the brute that was brutalizing us. And today, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is showing black people in this country that just as the white man and every other person on this earth has God-given rights, natural rights, civil rights, any kind of rights that you can think of when it comes to defending himself, black people should have, we should have the right to defend ourselves also.
So I think that's Professor Peniel Joseph, who had to leave us, was trying to say about Malcolm X. And this is early Malcolm X, by the
right.
way,
right.
affirming black humanity in that way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that is it's such a critical point and so misunderstood among people who don't know Malcolm X. And you know, Dr. King, you know, who we all love and adore, you know, affirmed, as Peniel was saying, you know, wanted us to love our enemies, right? This is our, you know, Malcolm understood that first we had to love ourselves, that in fact we did not love ourselves and had not loved ourselves. And he could speak with authority to that, to the, especially to an urban black male population, because he had lived all the manifestations of that taught, right, self-hatred, you know, with drug use and, you know, criminal activity. And so he was so extraordinary in so many ways. First of all, affirming the righteous, you know, greatness of black people, making a connection to Africa, right? He was the one who set Alex Haley, who of course wrote the autobiography of Malcolm X. He was the one who set Alex Haley on his path towards roots and towards the reconnection of black people in this country to Africa. He was the one who began speaking about black people's civil rights here in terms of a global civil rights, right? The African diaspora, the rights of Africans getting out of colonialism. I mean, he was just extraordinary in so many ways. He was going to take the United States before the UN. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just an extraordinary leader and so important. And I teach his autobiography every semester. And every semester, I'm amazed at how many students have such a very limited and narrow view of him, but I think it's important that view be broadened.
And speaking of that narrow view, because for a lot of people, as Dr. King is sort of stuck in time, mm-hmm. Malcolm X is also stuck in time too, mm-hmm. and sort of the latter part of his life where he came to realize that there was a humanity that he wanted to have unified to sort of fight issues on behalf of some of the egregious stuff that happened to black people. He was the original, if you will, Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. if you were thinking mm-hmm. about Black Lives Matter, and there's a reason we're saying that,
right.
but we're talking about embracing all folks to support that.
Well, that's right,
yeah.
and I think we have to put it also in context when Malcolm X was speaking. I'm not talking about the other Malcolm X we often refer to, his transformation post-Mecca, but I'm also thinking about the Malcolm X of the 1950s and 60s. This was a Malcolm X of at a time of extreme violent anti-black sentiment in this country, and a lot of that violent anti-black sentiment wasn't just just coming from some of the population, people in the South and those in the North who militated against black people. But I'm talking about intelligence services, our FBI, our police, particularly the New York Police Department, which had a vendetta, actually, against Malcolm X, but also carried on a campaign of Black Lives Don't Matter in the context of everyday business, the New York Police Department, and many police departments across the country. I say that because it's important to put into context also, Callie and Kim, that at a time when we're talking about Edward Snowden and we're talking about terrorism threats against this country, we might notice that the type of what is considered a great threat against this country has changed dramatically. It's no longer in the Malcolm X's of the world. It's now we're talking about radical jihadism and so on and so forth when we talk about terrorism and threats against this country. But in Malcolm X's day, it was black people, particularly so-called militants, who were considered the main threat against this country. And Malcolm X was considered a major threat. Thus, you had a campaign to divide black people. The right. COINTELPRO program that was, which basically was created to divide a lot of people,
right.
but it succeeded in basically creating a lot of enmity between black forces, those of Elijah Muhammad, and then the post of Malcolm, and when Malcolm X broke from Elijah Muhammad, you basically had black people pitted against black people by very formidable intelligence services. J. Edgar Hoover, absolutely, he didn't just hate Martin Luther King, he hated Malcolm X.
Right. No, he was vicious.
And so but in the center of all this, yes. Malcolm X being, you know, I just want to make that connection to Black Lives Matter now because I think it's so
important.
It's important.
Absolutely.
And so clear with hindsight.
That's right.
And I also want to connect him because it's interesting as we're looking at this week's in history, the events in this week's history, we take a look and notice that Lorraine Hansberry, renowned African-American playwright, I think first person to get a play on Broadway, Raisin in the Sun, it's become a classic now, what they were born 5 days apart in the same. And they addressed the oppression of black people in very different ways.
That's
she broached hers through her writing and the culture and how she stated it in in the play that has become a classic and then other work that
she
did.
But a connecting thread between those two, too. And I don't know that they...
And they're 5 years apart. I said five years apart.
It'd be interesting to imagine if they ever met. They both, of course, met James Baldwin, who might have been a kind of central figure. But a connecting figure between especially Raisin in the Sun and Malcolm X is the celebration and the support of black manhood, right? I mean, you know, when Malcolm X died, Ossie Davis, who memorialized him, said he was our black manhood. And what Lorraine Hansberry was exploring in Raisin in the Sun, in addition to black family, was black manhood and how diminished that is under a racist, oppressive system and how necessary that is to rebuild that and reestablish that before we move forward as a people. And so in some ways they were on maybe different ends of the spectrum in terms of radicalness, but they're very much working towards the same goal of acknowledging, you know, supporting and ratifying black masculinity as important under the weight of, you know, 350 years of racist oppression.
The same goal, but also not just an affirmation of views of black manhood, but also of different ways of looking at how do you ascend? How do you basically get from point A to B? Lorraine Hansberry, I also think about A Raisin in the Sun, because I think about her paradigmatic view of the middle class. And how do you get from basically one point, and we go back to Chicago, where Raisin in the Sun is set, and how do you ascend from living in this ghetto, essentially, to ascending to the middle class?
What does that mean?
You're African American in a segregated society where, in fact, there are covenants that existed at the time where you could not move into certain neighborhoods, where you could not ascend. It didn't matter if you dreamed and you fought and you basically attained the money that you needed in order to get from point A to point B. How do you get there was the question that was posed by both Lorraine Hansberry and, of course, by Malcolm X. And they got there, as you you pointed out, in different ways. But in many ways, there was a nexus. And that nexus happened to be, you know, like an objective view of racism in America. And how do you basically cut through that? Malcolm X said, you basically, by any means necessary. Lorraine Hansberry said, you know, like that you basically work with these dreams. You work hard, and you go step by step, and you basically have to get, you have to basically overcome the conflict within families in order to get from point A to point B.
Well, you have to stay together.
I think she said
That's
more than that, actually. I think she also said, let me show the rest of America what it takes to be in my skin.
Precisely.
And to be in our skin. And then, you know, with awareness comes some other kinds of progress, because she was very political in the way that she operated.
Yeah,
she was. So let me also bring up, and again, this is connected to the Black Lives Matter group writ large. This week in history, North Carolina A&T cops came onto the campus. That was a, you know, it was a terrible situation, and you think about that back in the day, and now you're seeing it, and it appears new, but it isn't, is my point.
Well, this is what I mean when I talk about the extreme violence of that period. I can't understate just how violent our nation was in terms of its anti-black sentiment. Mm-hmm. We like to talk about the dreams that were occurring concomitantly and the opportunities, and those things were happening. But there was also a lot of resistance. And I think the reason I think about A&T in North Carolina, Greensboro, the reason I think about it a lot is when I juxtapose the type of emotional response we had to Kent State a few years later, when National Guardsmen came on campus and shot students to death. Willie Grimes was shot to death in 1969, the black man who was killed in 1969. What this was all about, of course, was a high school, a valedictorian, had basically been was selected to give the speech. But the school resisted, said, no, you can't give the speech because we think you subscribe to black militant beliefs. Mm. So therefore, you cannot give this speech. This student, the high school students were supported by students at the local university. That turned into a major, major protest. And that protest was met violence by police and National Guards National Guardsmen who came onto the campus. And essentially, black lives did not matter because one was taken. And this guy was essentially Willie Grimes, a symbol, was considered someone who was a bystander, who was looking on as these things were taking
place.
Which
often happens. And the fact the point you're making, that the fact that that incident is not as well known as Kent State is collectively in our history, does speak to the value with which black lives are held.
Police went onto the campus, it was a protest, and white students were killed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it is interesting just to make these comparisons today. Now, in the same education arena, 50 years ago, Head Start started, part of the anti-war program. Johnson thought this is going to pull together, really, really close a gap, an educational gap that needed to be closed, certainly with communities that were considered disadvantaged, and often many of those were African-American communities. And what an impact that program has made.
Tremendous impact, and it's discouraging that it is still underfunded and every year has to battle for continuing funding. We know the value of a high quality, and there's been some problems with Head Start, but by and large, we know the value of high quality preschool for all young people, but particularly low-income children. And Head Start has quantified that these students make significant gains in when they attend Head Start. Now, some of those gains, the problem is that some of those gains are subsequently lost later on as they progress through schools. But that doesn't mitigate against Head Start. That mitigates for more involvement and more resources in our public schools to support low-income students. You know, students come with all kinds of issues, low income, poverty, you know, parents who are involved in the justice system. All of these factors help determine how well a child will succeed in school. And to the extent that Head Start can mitigate these factors, it's a huge success and tremendously important.
And I want to point out that a few years ago, a couple of years ago, Head Start got hit with some of the sequestration cuts.
Across-the-board cuts that
Congress put in place. And a lot of students here in Massachusetts and in other states, too, were very significantly impacted. And what we do know, whether or not there is loss later on by some students, if you start off kids early with this kind of education, with more words spoken in, to them, because we now know the difference often in these between the affluent households and others, is that there are more words spoken.
Absolutely.
Just right. A simple, something that simple.
Sure.
And by the way, I just want to let people know we're going to continue this conversation online and looking back at other events in history. But Philip, you know, speak to that, because what the research now is even more affirming. We know you get to those young brains sooner. You know, it helps.
Right. Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you think again about the Lyndon B. Johnson and many of the programs that he pushed and so on and so forth, championed, and others who took on these programs, you think about welfare. While welfare has become in many ways a proxy for race, Head Start was something that conservatives and liberals for a long time agreed on. They agreed that the benefit of Head Start was phenomenal and advantageous. Nixon was a huge supporter of the Head Start program because he felt that it was advantageous. Even in the 1980s, you found conservatives aligned with Ronald Reagan, who found Head Start to be important. Unfortunately, we're in a different time where even Head Start, a program as sacrosanct in many ways as Head Start, is under attack because it's considered, you know, like a drain on public budgets. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Even while we're buying.
To continue the conversation, see past episodes, or discover new stories, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
Again, not just because of sequestration, but also because of a mentality that spending government money, no matter what its intentions, in order to lift people out of poverty, some people still find problematic. For a while you had consensus, now you have, unfortunately, disagreement.
Now here's what's interesting to me. There seems to be a growing consensus around kindergarten, you know, free kindergarten,
slowly,
which really
slowly.
Is
very slowly.
Yes, but isn't that a variation of Head Start, right? So in terms of understanding that early makes a difference.
Yes, right. It is, but it is. But Head Start was something broader. Head Start had a broader impact. For one thing, it starts earlier.
Right. Yes,
whole notion of Head Start is a Head Start.
Right.
A recognition that if you, as you pointed out, if a kid is given the same opportunity.